Then you agree it must be done?
Entirely, she said, and you may rely on my discretion. Relief chased the tension from his shoulders. It felt good to share the burden and to know that she approved. A few more days, that's all. A few more days to hold the course.
We must gather the others, he said. I promised them answers when we got to Morganholm, and I cannot put it off any longer. They have been sorely taxed, and I fear their loyalty is rubbing thin. I need them to believe.
What will you tell them?
What they need to know. The rest they'll understand afterwards.
Afterwards, said Mara, with something like reverence in her voice. Everything will be different afterwards.
65. They gathered in the drawing room, pulled the drapes closed, and locked the doors. When the room was secure, they settled themselves and looked towards Garrick, who stood at the centre of attention. Wall lamps cast conspiratorial shadows across their faces.
Here we are, then, he said.
Aaron felt the thrill of treachery. This was how it was in the stories. They were plotters now, meeting to discuss secret plans. Cade, who was sitting next to him on an ornate and uncomfortable settee, was practically jigging with excitement. There were seven of them present. Besides Garrick and Cade, there was their host, Mara, a stern, wiry woman with wolf-grey hair. Grubb lounged in a chair with one leg thrown over the arm, gnawing a turkey wing he'd salvaged from the dinner table. Fenn leaned against a wall, arms crossed, her body language aloof and defensive. Aaron's gaze lingered on her face for a moment, then moved on to Keel, who sat slumped in a wooden seat. The Bitterbracker's shoulders sagged, and his eyes were hollow. He'd hardly spoken since they left Rackham Bay. Aaron had never seen a man so laden with care. Four were absent. Vika was abed, with Ruck no doubt sleeping at her feet. The hound had been let into her room once she'd been made comfortable. Aaron was worried about her, they all were, but the improvement in her condition had given them cause to hope. Harrod and Orica were not invited, and had chosen to remain in the gardens while Orica practiced her lute. Aaron felt vaguely bad about that, for they'd travelled together long enough that he considered them companions, but he understood the need for secrecy. They were not part of this.
"I've asked much of you all," said Garrick. "More than I had a right to, I reckon. After Salt Fork all seemed lost. Then we had news of the wedding and the return of the Ember Blade. Some of you have followed me since then, through great loss and trial. Others have joined along the way, despite my best efforts to the contrary." He gave Aaron a pointed glare. "Through it all, I've asked you to journey in the dark, not knowing the details of our mission. I make no apologies for that. All of us know how good the Crodans are at loosening tongues and twisting men's loyalties."
His face darkened then, and Aaron knew he was recalling past betrayals.
"But there comes a time when faith must have its reward, so I'll tell you now what I intend."
Cade sat up, bright-eyed, and gave Aaron a nudge. Aaron grinned at him. They knew Garrick was after the Ember Blade. They'd waited a long time to find out how he planned to get it.
9 days from now, Prince Ottica of Croda and Princess Sorrel of Harrow will be wed," Garrick began. "Croda's alliance with Harrow will secure the northern border of Ossia, leaving them free to consolidate their hold on our land until it is unbreakable. This is our last chance to make the people of Ossia stand up for themselves. There won't be another."
"The Ember Blade,"
Grubb cried through a mouthful of meat, thrusting the bone in the air. Aaron thought it curious that he, of all of them, should be the one to call its name.
"The Ember Blade," said Garrick.
His face became grim.
"Aye, the Ember Blade. Our symbol of the right to rule, the standard of Ossia itself, stolen from us 30 years ago. Now it's coming back, to be put in the hands of our new Lord Protector, the Emperor's heir. I'll be God's damned if I'll let that happen. We need to show our kinfolk they weren't meant to be ruled.
That blade is the sign of the Aspect's favor, and if we had it, they'd flock to us. We could take our country back.
The passion was plain in him now, and it awoke an answering passion in his audience. Aaron felt a surge of pride in his breast, and this time he didn't try to quell it. The Ember Blade. It represented the opposite of everything Croden, an idea of freedom and liberty bred into the fibre of his people. Even a boy raised to ape their masters, as Aaron was, had a deep-seated veneration for the Ember Blade. Now he embraced it, claimed it as his own. He was a child of Ossia, after all.
"Hammerholt is 6 leagues from here. That's where the wedding is to be held," said Garrick. "It is the most formidable fortress in Ossia, and it will be more heavily guarded than the most precious trove. But the wedding will bring chaos, hundreds of artisans, guests and servants moving in and out. Most of the Croden High Command in Ossia are arriving over the next couple of days to meet their new Lord Protector and to organize the smooth handover of our country. We believe the Ember Blade is already there, brought in secret from Falcon's Reach some time ago. As the wedding approaches, the Crodens will be at their most alert, looking for any attempt to disrupt the proceedings. That is why we will steal the Ember Blade several days before it takes place."
"How do we get inside?" asked Aaron, unable to contain himself.
"You don't," said Garrick. "None of you are going inside. Only me."
Aaron felt that like a slap in the face. He'd assumed he'd be part of the adventure when it came, whether it was to be a daring theft or a breathless battle. The boy in him still believed he'd be the hero of the tale Cade would one day tell. With a few words, Garrick killed that dream and humbled him again.
"The Master Vintner of Morgenholm is the only one licensed to supply wine to the Imperial family," Garrick continued, heedless of the hurt writ plain on Aaron's face. "It's well known the prince will have no sweet wine but amberline with his dessert. It's one of the few things he likes about our country. Several cartloads of amberline will therefore be travelling from the Master Vintner's cellars to Hammerholt. I intend to be on one of them."
"How?" Aaron said, spurred by dismay to bloody-minded obstructiveness. "They'll search every cart top to bottom, and you'll never hide that scar on your throat." "They will indeed search every cart," said Mara, her words crisp and perfectly enunciated. "But they will not find him. We have constructed a replica of one of the Master Vintner's carts, identical but for a single detail, a secret compartment just big enough for Garrick to squeeze inside. He will be transported by an unwitting driver, who will be a trusted member of the Master Vintner's staff and unlikely to draw suspicion. Once past the guards and inside, Garrick will emerge wearing the livery of a Croden servant, whose uniforms, as fortune has it, incorporate a high collar. That, and a good shave, will render him all but unrecognizable."
"She knew, and I didn't," Keel said, stirring from his misery to shoot Garrick an accusing glare. "I wrote to her from Rackon Bay so she might commission everything we need," said Garrick. "She worked the rest out herself."
Keel gave her a sullen look and shook his head angrily. Aaron's mind worked fast. A childish desire for vengeance made him want to poke holes in Garrick's plan. "You wrote from Rackon Bay?" he said. Even by fastest post it couldn't have been 9 days since it arrived. 9 days to have a copy of a particular cart built, with a secret compartment to boot.
"And replica barrels of amberline commissioned, and more besides," said Mara.
"Pay enough, and you can get anything done in a hurry. Your point?" "Why didn't he send that letter a month ago? Or two? Why not right after Salt Fork, when the wedding was announced and he set out for Hammerholt?"
That piqued Fenn's interest.
She turned her eyes expectantly to Garrick, waiting for an answer. Mara raised an eyebrow at Aaron in approval.
"Because he didn't have a plan till then," said Keel sourly. "He led us all the way from Salt Fork to steal the Ember Blade, but it took him till Rackon Bay to work out how."
Aaron was taken aback at the tone of his voice. Garrick and Keel had always been close as brothers, but he heard the raw edge of resentment now. Did Keel blame Garrick for the fact that he had to leave his family behind? That hardly seemed just.
If anyone was to blame, it was Aaron for joining the fight at the Reaver's Rest.
"Is that true?" Fenn asked in surprise.
"Hollow man not know what he is doing all along," Grubb exclaimed. "Ha! Should have followed Grubb. Grubb always have a plan."
"Oh, aye," said Cade. "And what's your plan now?"
"Eat turkey," said Grubb, and proceeded to do so.
"I told you we'd seize the Ember Blade for ourselves, and I told you I'd explain the plan when we got to Morganholm," Garrick said bullishly. "Would you have followed me elsewise? Keel? Fenn? Or would you now be wandering the land, watching forlornly as the Crodans crush the last of the spirit from your countrymen?"
Aaron's gaze went to the castle's board set up by the empty hearth, and he heard Master Fasson's voice in his mind. "Never let your opponent see you uncertain. Behave as if you have a strategy, even when you do not. Act as if your opponent's every move is playing further into your hands."
"You said the driver won't know you're there," said Aaron. "How?"
"The Amber Line will be delivered to the castle some days before the wedding," he said. "Before that happens, we'll break into the vintner's yard and switch our cart and barrels for one of the real ones. When they set off, I'll be inside."
"Grubb good at breaking into things."
"Alas," said Mara, "that job has already been entrusted to another."
"Aye," said Garrick. "A man who knows Morganholm and our cause and is best placed to get it done. I have been fighting the Crodans 30 years now, and I have travelled the breadth of this land. The faces you see here are not the limit of my allies."
"I knew you were a Greycloak," Cade exclaimed.
"There's no such thing as the Greycloaks," Keel told him wearily.
"Then what are we to do?" Aaron cried, frustrated. "What's our purpose here, if you already have all you need?"
Garrick rounded on him.
"Do you think it all ends with Otico's wedding, boy?" he snarled. "Do you imagine the Crodans will leave once we've taken the Ember Blade? If I succeed, it will be the beginning. All of you will be needed, and many more besides, if we are to carry the flame forward. Do not be so hungry to rush into danger. It will find you soon enough."
Aaron slumped back in the settee, scowling. This wasn't what he'd imagined when he chose to stay with Garrick at the Reaver's Rest. He was nothing but a support player, a footnote, condemned to watch while another man wrote himself into legend. He didn't crave adulation or excitement, but when bards sang of the day Ossia reclaimed the Ember Blade, he wanted to at least get a mention.
"Grubb not happy about this," said the Skarl,
his turkey wing now laid on the arm of his chair, where it oozed onto the fabric.
"Mudslug not happy either, he thinks. Dumbface doesn't mind, but Dumbface not brave like us."
"Dumbface?" Cade nearly screamed.
Garrick raised a hand to silence them.
"Once I'm inside, I'll have to make my way through Hammerholt without capture. For that, I need a map of the castle and information about the preparations so I can work unobserved. No doubt I will have to pass through areas where servants are not allowed, and to find the Ember Blade I first need to know where they are keeping it. All this was entrusted to a sard named Yarin, an acquaintance of Mara's and mine, and no friend to the Crodans. I sent to him immediately when the wedding was announced, and he'd been investigating ever since, through whatever secret channels he knows. But now Yarin is gone, the sards in the ghetto cleared out and taken."
Aaron sat up in alarm.
"They're gone?"
"Aye. To what destination no one knows."
Aaron's eyes went to the mark on his wrist. Sard friend. His whole life he'd been told to treat them with suspicion and scorn, when he'd thought of them at all. Without that mark, he might not have helped Orica in her time of need. He'd certainly have turned a blind eye to what was happening in his land, as many of his countryfolk had. The Sards were little loved, and many people were just glad to be rid of them. But things were different now. Aaron's promise to Ethan was fulfilled, but that scarcely mattered. He'd been made to care, and he couldn't undo that. "Who's going to tell Orica?" he thought. But he already knew the answer. It would have to be him, It was his duty, as a Sard friend.
"Yarin did obtain the information," said Mara. "He stashed it inside the ghetto, but no one is allowed inside, and it is heavily patrolled."
"Tomorrow night I'm going in to get it back," said Garrick. "And now you know as much as I do. I've trusted you with the details of our plan, so I want you to trust me. Maybe this business with the Ember Blade won't give you the chance to wet your blades as you'd like. Maybe you think there's little glory in it for you. But hear you me, there'll be plenty of glory to come, and plenty of chances to prove your worth in the revolution. Till then, I need to know I can count on you to do what needs to be done, even if that's to wait."
There was silence in the room. Their faces were thoughtful and grim in the lamplight. Finally, Fenn stirred. "Whatever needs to be done," she said. Cade instinctively looked to Aaron for a cue, then decided he didn't need one.
"Aye," he said. "We've come this far. I'm with you."
"Grubb don't think any of this is going to get him a good tattoo," he grumbled. "He still help, though."
Aaron fought down the urge to sulk and forced himself to swallow his pride and disappointment. Angry as he was, this choice had already been made. He told himself that retrieving the Ember Blade was what mattered here. It was bigger than him, bigger than his resentment of Garrick, but still he felt the sting of it.
"I'm with you," he said, his voice flat. "Whatever needs to be done."
"Keel?"
Garrick asked. Keel looked up, his eyes refocused.
"Yes," he said,
but it was clear he hadn't been listening, that his thoughts had been elsewhere, with his family. Garrick's gaze lingered on him uncertainly. Then he drew himself up and addressed them all.
"Get some sleep," he said. "Speak of this to no one. In a few days, we make our move."
66.
"Daddy!"
Clisson was hardly inside before Lisi and Juna came charging along the corridor, drawn by the sound of his key in the lock. He knelt down and they flew into his arms in a giggling, wriggling tumble of blonde curls, frills and sweet breath. He kissed them both, laughing with delight.
"How you've grown," he told them. "You'll be taller than your mother soon."
"Silly," they called him, for they were hardly half her height yet, but they squirmed with pleasure at the thought.
"Ah, is that Baron Pickles?"
Clisson exclaimed as a fat white cat, sour-featured and groomed to within an inch of its life, wandered out from a doorway to investigate the commotion.
"Come here, you soft old thing."
Baron Pickles regarded him blandly for a moment, then drifted back into the room he came from, unimpressed by the return of the master of the house.
"Baron Pickles, come and say hello to Daddy,"
Juno demanded with the comical sternness of a four-year-old. She was about to go and retrieve the cat, willingly or not, but Clisson stopped her.
"Wait, Juno. I've brought presents."
"Presents!"
They attacked immediately, squealing at ear-shredding pitch, their excitement spilling over into violence as they tugged at him.
"Presents! Presents!" they sang,
whirling around in his arms.
"Peace, children," he cried. "What is the credo of the Sanctorum? Can you recite it for me?"
"Diligence, temperance, dominance,"
they chanted together.
"Yes, temperance,"
said Clisson.
"Be calm and moderate in your passions. Can you be calm?"
"Yes, Daddy,"
they muttered grudgingly. They put their hands behind their backs, barely able to contain their anticipation. He dug into his bag and found the dolls he'd bought from a dollmaker on Kingsgrove Street, exquisitely fashioned and eye-wateringly expensive. Privately, he thought that two girls of 4 and 6 couldn't tell the difference between a finely made doll and a 5-decim toy from the shackle market, and wouldn't care if they could. But Vanya didn't want cheap dolls in the house. She said they made the place look tawdry. The girls snatched them out of his hands, gasping at their good fortune.
"Mine's Princess Sorrel," Lisi insisted. "No, mine's Princess Sorrel," Juno said crossly.
"They can both be Princess Sorrel," said Clisson,
though neither looked anything like her if her portraits were true. This, according to the unique logic of children, was an acceptable solution. "What do you say when you receive a gift?"
"Thank you, Daddy," they yelled in discordant chorus.
The sight of his wife at the end of the corridor brought him to his feet. She'd been watching him with their daughters. Now their eyes met, and she smiled. Clisson felt himself go momentarily weak, his will lost in the glare of admiration. Vanya was a tall woman, taller than him, with grey blue eyes, a lion's mane of blonde curls, and a face so beautiful and unflawed that it seemed she'd been cut from some other material than fallible flesh, forged without corruption by the Primus himself. He didn't have an artistic bone in his body, but she made him believe in poetry.
"Marius," she said, "husband."
He went to her, and they kissed, a brief press of the lips, too quick to account for the months they'd been apart. She left him elated and frustrated, but that was how her kisses were. He always wanted more. "I have a gift for you too," he said. He reached into his bag again, adjusting his spectacles with one hand as he rummaged inside with the other. Finally, he drew out a small leather-bound box and offered it to her. Her eyes betrayed a flicker of hungry interest as she saw the filigreed emblem there. Axus and Thrain, her favourite jewellers.
"Marius, how thoughtful," she said,
with the slightly wary tone of someone who wasn't entirely sure she'd like what she found inside. She opened the box with elegant and perfectly manicured fingers. Clisson watched her face in the grip of an excitement that was more than half fear. When he saw her light up with genuine unfeigned pleasure, he felt a little cascade of joy tumble through him.
"Oh, it's beautiful!"
She sighed as she lifted the necklace from the box. He could hardly stop himself from grinning.
"The diamonds are from Helica, yes, I see that," she murmured appreciatively.
He marvelled at her near-supernatural ability to identify the provenance of gemstones at a glance. He'd have picked the sapphires, which glittered more brightly, complemented her eyes, and were significantly cheaper. This necklace looked rather simple and plain by comparison, barely distinguishable from others one-tenth its price. But he'd learned not to trust his own judgment in matters of fashion, so he'd wisely asked the jeweller's wife for advice.
"Breathtaking, my love," he said, after he'd put it round her neck.
She kissed him. This time he felt passion in it and flushed.
"Ew!"
cried Lisi. They broke apart to find the girls giggling at them, their dolls forgotten in their hands.
"What are you giggling about?"
Clisson demanded playfully. He lunged at them with his hands made into claws.
"Come here, you scamps!"
The girls squealed in delighted fright, and their father chased them from the room, snarling like a monster as he went. They dined together after he saw the children to bed with kisses and a story. Marla, the housekeeper, saved them platters of good Croden fare, pork brisket in sour apple sauce, butterflied potatoes, steamed cabbage and roasted turnip, washed down with rich, heavy red wine from the homeland. Candlelight glittered on cut crystal glasses, sparkled from silver knives and Vanya's new necklace. A portrait of the Emperor and his only son overlooked the table. Kelsing the Fourth, bald, bejacketed and sporting a bushy beard, had his hand on Prince Otiko's shoulder. Otiko was 14 or thereabouts, his short curly hair black as his father's beard, pale eyes gazing out with all the arrogance and hauteur of a young man born to rule. Above the portrait, rendered in iron, was the symbol of the Sanctorum, a blade laid point downwards across an open book. The Emperor and the Sanctorum, the twin pillars of modern Croden society. Clisson had put them there as a reminder of what he was fighting for, what they were all fighting for. The Ossians dreamed of the past, but Crodans rejected it, for these were their days of glory. Croda was an ailing country once, beset by barbarians and menaced by its neighbours. Its ancestral territories in Ozak and Brunland had been lost to independence movements they were too weak to oppose. Then came Thomas and Toven, one a charismatic and radical preacher, the other a young war hero. They brought word of the Primus, and the people listened, for the aspects of old hadn't served them well. At last they were brought before the Emperor, Stepan III. He was convinced by them, and declared them heralds of the true God. He outlawed all other religions, and gave his support to the nascent Sanctorum, the followers of Thomas and Toven, so they might spread their credo of discipline and martial order throughout the land. Croda had never looked back. In the 2 centuries since, they'd reclaimed their lost lands, annexed Estria, and invaded Ossia. Even mighty Harrow would rather make alliance with them than oppose them, and Clisson was confident that they'd one day become part of the Empire in their turn. If they were not conquered by force of arms, they'd collapse from within. Ossified by tradition and heritage, they were a culture incapable of change. They'd crumble, like the ruins of the Second Empire, or be crushed in the fullness of time beneath the wheel of Crodan progress. Croda was the chosen land, meant to rule its weaker neighbours by divine mandate. Anyone who didn't believe that was a fool.
"How goes your search for the fugitive?" Vanya asked.
She kept to small portions, mindful of her figure. "He is shy prey, but I will catch him in the end," said Clisson. "He has eluded me twice, but only by good fortune, and luck is a poor ally, apt to desert you when you need it most. I am ahead of him again. He will not escape a third time."
"It is suspicious that such a dangerous criminal should be headed to Morgenholm so close to the prince's wedding," she observed.
"I thought the same thing. No doubt he has some mischief in mind, though I have little confidence in his ability to execute it. The men we caught at Salt Fork revealed the truth about these rebels. They're a ragtag band, no more than opportunistic bandits. Ossians are incapable of cooperating for long enough to organize themselves." He pushed his spectacles back up his nose. "Still, one zealous renegade can do a lot of damage if given the chance. I will have him before the wedding bells ring, do not fear."
"Unless Hart sabotages your endeavour," she said bitterly.
"He has been quiet since Rackon Bay, when I put him in his place."
"Good," she said, with a firm nod of approval.
She liked it when he was assertive and commanding. He chewed thoughtfully on his brisket. "In truth, I'm no longer sure he is trying to sabotage me. At first I was certain he was sent by Commander Gossen, but of late I've begun to believe the truth is simpler. I think he's no more than an odious man who enjoys dispensing brutality in the guise of justice." There was a clatter as Vanya put down her knife and fork.
"Do not be fooled," she told him sternly. "The Commander is jealous of you, they all are. If it were up to them, all positions of authority would be filled with men like Hart. Oh, they may project an image of Crodan superiority to impress the world, but they possess none of the intelligence which made us superior in the first place. They are arrogant, dull, entitled men who will weaken the Empire with their feeble-mindedness. It frightens them to see a man of ability who has climbed the ranks by virtue of hard work and a keen mind. They will do all they can to stop you. Be vigilant, Marius, be ruthless. The Commander's post is yours by right."
"Take care, Vanya. Guard your words. I am an overwatchman of the Iron Hand, after all," he said. But he smiled to show he was joking. Her words pleased him, even though he knew she was only echoing his own complaints, which she'd heard many times before. It didn't matter. He had her support, and it made him feel strong.
"An overwatchman now, but a commander soon. And then?"
"Then back to Croda," he said, because all conversations with his wife led that way eventually. "Back to Falcon's Reach as soon as we can, my love. I have no more affection for this land than you do." She sighed and took up her cutlery again.
"I do so long for home," she said, cutting a tiny slice of turnip. "The balls, the theatre, the fashions, the food. This place is a decade behind in every way, a cultural wasteland, and the society. The same faces over and over. If I have to attend one more gathering at the Danas—" "There are opportunities here," he reminded her. I am working towards our return with all haste, but I can't even invite my friends over any more. Marius, you don't know how lonely I am when you're away.
You can't?
Why not?
He asked, and immediately regretted it.
Because our parlour is so detestably shabby. Nobody has pale blue walls any more. The seats are all but worn through.
I don't think they're quite that bad.
They are, Marius. And the settees and curtains are so out of date. I tell you, our guests would laugh at us. The whole room needs updating before I would dare let anyone see it.
When I'm commander, that could be months away.
What am I to do while you're off seeking the enemies of the Empire? I cannot go to balls without my husband. Am I to be a prisoner here?
He wanted to say that there were plenty of diversions she could occupy herself with, plenty of people to visit, plenty of places to go. He wanted to say that she scarcely seemed to be at home, even when he was there. She was always off to this or that social occasion, sporting a new hat, new shoes, or a new dress. But he said nothing. He knew the futility of such arguments. He was only likely to be home for a week at most, and he wanted it to be a pleasant week. Granting her this would see her compliant, attentive, and energetic in bed. Refusing it would damn him to cold wrath until his departure. He could hardly afford it, but it didn't seem like he had much choice.
"Kerin will have to design it," she warned, pressing the advantage as she saw him falter. "I'll trust no other. No one has his taste."
"Kerin? Again?" Clisson protested feebly.
"He's the best," she said.
"And the most expensive. The Nemesis, take that popinjay. It feels like half my wealth has gone into his pockets over the years." "Very well," he said, mentally counting the damage. "Kerin, it shall be." He was beginning to sulk, but she broke into a smile and came round the table to kiss him.
"Thank you, Marius. You're so generous, so kind to me. I don't know what I'd do without you. You make me so happy."
"To see you happy is my heart's desire," he told her, and meant it. She kissed him again, and after that the money didn't seem to matter so much. After dinner, Clisson went to his study on the top floor of the townhouse. From there, shutters opened onto a cramped balcony with wrought iron railings. There was a single chair at one end and a brass telescope on a tripod at the other. He sat with a sigh, a Caraguan cigar smoking between his fingers. He took a long draw, savouring the hot herbal smoke, and blew out a luxuriant cloud from his nostrils. He'd pay for it with a bellyache in the morning. Cigars irritated his delicate stomach, but he felt reckless tonight. The city spread out beneath him. His home was in South Heights, and from his vantage he could see all the way down the hill to the river, where Sovereign's Isle was a lacework of lights in the void. There were no moons in the sky, but the tangled city illuminated the night with a soft yellow glow. To the east, the Catsclaw Mountains were dark waves in the distance. Morganholm had none of the ordered beauty of Falcon's Reach, the imperial city, with its magnificent boulevards stretching long and straight beneath triumphal arches. Yet if a man looked hard enough, he might find order in the most bewildering chaos. Their cultures were worlds apart, but Ossians and Crodans had the same needs, the same capacity for love and hate, jealousy, kindness and greed. Once you understood a person's needs and fears, you could bend them to your will. These people would learn discipline in the end, and so lift themselves out of the mire of decadence and criminality. With the Emperor's guiding hand, they'd be great again, part of the most powerful empire the world had ever known. Baron Pickles ambled onto the balcony. Spotting a likely-looking lap, he hopped up and settled himself there. Clisson absently scratched the cat's ears, took another draw on his cigar, and looked at the stars overhead. There was the hangman, there the crayfish, there the path of jewels, the bright smear in the night that the Ossians called Joha's River. The locals claimed that every star was a glittering shard of an unknowable creator god who shattered into a million pieces to give light and life to the empty void, with nine facets of his being set to watch over creation, the nine aspects.
Clisson knew better. His father had shown him the hand of the Primus in the sky, the clockwork dance of the universe, impossibly complex but perfectly ordered. Night after night, they went out into his parents' tiny garden to look up at the stars through the very same telescope he shared the balcony with. Clisson was a man without imagination, but he found wonder in those cold, distant lights.
"Would that you could see me now, Father. Would that you had lived to know what beautiful granddaughters you have, what a wife your son has caught. Ugly little Marius, whom the girls laughed at and the boys bullied. Nobody is laughing now."
In truth, he'd had little interest in women before Vanya found him, having long considered them unobtainable. It hadn't escaped his notice that the ladies began to pay him more attention as his rank increased, but by then he'd learned to do without them and paid them little mind. It was only when he was passed over for a promotion he surely deserved that they became suddenly important.
"The Empire likes a married man," a colleague told him. "You look a little strange and you ignore women. It's suspicious, that's all."
Clisson didn't want to be suspicious. Suspicion was a dangerous thing in the Crodan Empire. So he badgered his colleague until he agreed to invite him to a ball, and let it be known, subtly of course, that he was available. His memories of the early hours of the dance were excruciatingly awkward. He wasn't adept at small talk, and he didn't know how to dance. As he stood against the wall, drinking too much to cover his nerves, he was approached by a woman more captivating than any he'd ever seen. She talked to him as if he were a normal person, an equal, not some piteous wretch far beneath her notice. He made a hesitant joke, and she laughed. They talked all night, and he left the ball feeling dizzy. 6 months later, they were married. Before Vanya, nothing meant anything. He treasured nobody and had no lust for luxury. He only cared for his position and the satisfaction of serving the Empire. Afterwards, it was different. Vanya became his obsession, and in time she bore him two daughters whom he'd lay down his life for. "The things we value make us weak," he thought. Kiel's wife needed little persuasion to betray him. Her love for her son far outweighed her frayed and lamentable devotion to her wayward husband, and she was desperate to spare him any suffering. Clisson assured her they wouldn't be punished if she was open and honest. In her terror, she was eager to help. Though Kiel had kept much from her, she told what she knew of his companions and their movements. She gave him the name of an inn, the Burned Bear, where Kiel had begged her to send him a letter.
"Send the letter," Clisson told her.
"What should I put in?" she asked.
"The truth," he said.
She couldn't read or write, so she dictated her letter to a scribe. Even now, it waited at the Burned Bear for Kiel, and a dozen iron guardsmen waited with it. The jaws of the trap were set. All that was left was for Kiel to walk in.
"Husband?"
Vanya was at the door, a silk nightgown clinging to her curves.
"Will you come to bed?" she asked softly.
Baron Pickles jumped off as Clisson levered himself up and went into his study, grinding out his cigar in an ashtray on the desk as he passed.
"You'll bathe and clean your teeth first, though," she told him. "I can smell the smoke all over you."
"The things we value make us weak," he thought. "But a man who values nothing is hardly alive at all." 67. The next morning, Mara had a class to teach, and Garrick had some unspecified business in the city. He'd go to the ghetto after nightfall, he told the others. They were to stay inside and lie low. No sooner had he left than Aaron and Cade began lacing up their boots.
"Didn't Garrick tell us to stay here?" asked Fenn.
"Pfft," said Aaron. "He's no liege of mine."
"We're in Morganholm," Cade said, alive with excitement. "Ain't no chance I'm missing this. You come in."
"Grub is," cried the Skull, bounding in from the other room with flecks of his breakfast still stuck to his face. Fenn wavered, inexplicably nervous.
Cade couldn't understand why someone so brave and capable would hesitate at adventure, but then he didn't understand a lot about women. They operated by some mysterious logic that was incomprehensible to him, their moods swept here and there by secret currents of meaning and implication he wasn't capable of detecting. It was annoying in those he didn't like, alluring in those he did. "I'll come," she said at last. Cade favoured her with his widest grin, which for some reason always made her look perturbed. In the end, Harrod came with them too. Since the Crodans had cleared the ghetto, it was too dangerous for Orica to be outside. But they'd left almost everything behind when they fled Rackan Bay, and there were several things she needed, not least new strings for her lute. Against his will, Harrod was forced to leave her side to seek them. It was a bright, clear day, and the chill of autumn was in the air. The city was abuzz, restless with anticipation. Banners hung everywhere, and all the talk was of the wedding. Cade and Aaron wandered wide-eyed, drinking in their surroundings. They marvelled at the strange fashions and languages, and studied exotic wares in shop windows. Here stood a crumbling fountain, there a fragment of an ornamental wall. The ruins of the Second Empire surrounded them, towering over the streets or hiding round corners, quiet hints of former magnificence. Cade's chest swelled with triumph. Look where he was. No longer was he some carpenter's boy damned to a small life. He'd endured hardship and terror, but through it he'd found fellowship, a bond forged from shared danger and shared purpose that was altogether different from the knockabout friendships of the dockside boys in Shoal Point. His companions were his brothers and sisters in rebellion. Whether the grey cloaks were real or not, he felt like one now. What a story he'd have to tell when he returned home after the land was free again. Wouldn't Dar be proud of him then? They'd set out with no particular destination in mind, but it soon became clear that Harrod at least knew where he was going. "Have you been here before?" Aaron asked him. "In my youth," said Harrod. "The Shackle Market is this way." "Why is it called the Shackle Market?" Cade asked. Half his attention was taken up with watching Fenn, who had a habit of drifting away from them. "Because that is where your ancestors sold slaves," said Harrod, with obvious distaste. "Eh? When did Ossians keep slaves?" Cade asked Aaron. Aaron had some schooling, even if most of it was Croden. "From the middle years of the Second Empire," said Aaron, "till Queen Vambra outlawed it." Cade was appalled. "After we were all made slaves by the Urds? I thought Jessa Wolfsheart said there'd never be slaves after that." Aaron shrugged. "What's history but a series of lessons we didn't learn?" Harrod gave a haughty sniff. "Harrow has never allowed slavery," he said. "You don't need it. You've got tradition," said Aaron witheringly. "And half your country are still slaves." With that, he walked off ahead. Grubb cackled. "Ha! Ballhead got his mouth shut by Mudslug. Maybe your sweetheart write a song about that." Pleased with himself, he swaggered off after Aaron, leaving Harrod alone with Cade, taut with indignity. Cade felt sorry for the big knight. He was overproud, easily offended, and entirely without charm. In Harrow, his noble birth might have shielded him from abuse, but he'd clearly never met anyone like Grubb. High-born wit was no defence against the Skull's thuggish mockery, and Grubb, for his part, enjoyed having someone even less popular to pick on. "He's just a bit touchy, that's all," Cade offered as an excuse for Aaron's behaviour. "Doesn't like it when people criticise his homeland." He thought for a moment, then added, "Probably feels guilty for doing it himself all these years." "There is no need to apologise," he said. "Your friend is correct. The low folk are little more than slaves in my land without hope of freedom. Their chains are invisible, but no less secure for that. I have nothing to boast of." That surprised Cade. He'd never heard Harrod admit he was wrong before. Encouraged by this unexpected indication of humanity, he pressed further. "And how did your Orica find life in Harrow?" "Well enough. Better than Ossia, I dare say,"
He meant to end the conversation, but that only made Cade more determined to keep him talking. Cade took silence as a snub, and he hated nothing more than the thought that someone disliked him. "Because of the news about the ghetto?" Cade prompted. He gave Cade a sidelong glance. "The ghetto, and Tatterfane, and Maresmouth, and more besides. She grieves for her people and her family. She cannot even walk the streets of this city. East of here, the roads will only get more dangerous as we near Croda, but east is where the Sards have been taken. She must choose whether to follow her family to almost certain capture, or abandon her search while she still can."
"And go back to Harrow with you?"
Harrod kept his eyes stiffly forward. "We cannot go back to Harrow." They walked on for a short while, till Cade could bear it no longer.
Why not?" he prompted.
Harrod's head whipped around, and he gave Cade a look of angry disbelief. No one in Harrow would be so impertinent. But they were not in Harrow now, and Cade was nothing if not tactless and intrusive.
"Well, because—" he stammered.
"You might as well tell me," said Cade affably. "I'll only get it out of Orica if you don't. She's quite happy to talk about that kind of stuff."
Harrod looked like a man being slowly and gently strangled.
"You Ossians are quite brazen, aren't you?" he observed, his voice weak.
"Shameless," Cade agreed.
Harrod swallowed, his larynx bobbing up and down his long neck.
"Well," he said, defeated, "then I suppose I have no choice but to tell you. I am, as you know, a scion of High House Anselm. I was Sar Harrod once. I still am, I suppose, but now it seems inappropriate."
He took a moment to firm his resolve and went on. "I was betrothed to a daughter of another High House. Our marriage would have secured vital access to a mountain pass for my family, which would have halved the transportation costs of our goods from the coast. The lady was an admirable woman, intelligent and pleasant of face."
"Aye, but did you love her, though?"
Harrod visibly flinched at the word.
"That is not necessary for marriage," he said. "In Harrow, marriage is a matter of highest political importance, the glue that holds our society together. Only death can put man and wife asunder, and even to break a betrothal is unforgivable. It shames the whole family, a crime rank with disgrace that demands compensation."
His voice wobbled a little at the last.
"Then Orica came to your father's house and played for you," Cade said, beginning to understand.
"A song of such beauty."
Harrod stopped himself as his voice threatened to betray him again.
"So you left your family and broke off your marriage contract to go with her," said Cade in wonderment. "You knew you'd be disgraced and exiled. You gave up everything for a song."
Harrod said nothing, his eyes fixed on the middle distance, braced for mockery. But Cade didn't want to mock him. He was in awe. It was like one of his Mars tales, a story of heroism, sacrifice and glory such as they told of the old days. He'd never suspected that beneath Harrod's stuffy, solemn exterior beat the heart of a romantic.
"I hope I hear a song like that one day," he said.
Then he gave Harrod a pat on the arm and walked on ahead to catch up with Aaron. Harrod watched him go, faintly surprised by the boy's reaction. Unseen by anyone, a small smile of pride touched his lips. The Shackle Market was a swarm, a bewildering churn of people of all ages and races milling beneath a webwork of bunting and banners. It was held beneath the coral-coloured roof of the Parthena, a shallow dome standing on a dozen pillars that still bore the memory of thousand-year-old murals. Statues worn to lumps rested on corbels projecting from the dome's interior, aloof from the chaos below. Sparrows darted restlessly in the heights.
"Grub needs some time to himself," Grub told them, eyeing the crowd hungrily. His fingers wriggled in anticipation. "He find you all later."
He slid off into the market, oozing nefarious intent. Harrod excused himself too, and went to seek the items Orica needed. Fenn hovered on the edge of the market, shuffling from foot to foot and looking less than enthusiastic.
"Come on, let's go in,"
Aaron urged her gently. Cade frowned at his tone. There was some meaning there that he was missing, something in the way he said it. With an unpleasant shock, he realized there were private signals passing between them, right under his nose. Fenn gave Aaron a look that Cade couldn't read. Then she nodded, and they went inside. Cade trailed after them, his mood souring. They went from stall to stall, amazed at what they saw. A swarthy Carthanian sold caged cats of many breeds. A Zulan chimericist showed off a live feathered snake that he professed was his own creation, and charged passers-by a decim to touch it, or a half-guilder to have it draped around them. One stall was piled with fruit they'd never heard of before. Another offered antique Urd jewellery dug from the earth. They found a vendor selling carvings of Elleru whitewood. Fenn, who was keen on whittling, stopped to admire them, turning them over in her hands. Aaron picked one up and showed it to her. She gasped in delight, and Cade felt a bitter slither of envy in his gut. How had he missed it? Now he remembered Aaron comforting her in Skavengard, the way he stayed back to help her along that ledge, the two of them creeping off into the woods to hunt. A dozen other moments sprang to mind. He'd suspected something was up, but he'd never really let himself believe it. Perhaps it was his talk with Harrod that had opened his eyes, turned his thoughts to romance. Now he looked with a sharper gaze at the object of his affection, and he saw what should have been obvious all along. They moved on. Fenn flinched as she was buffeted in the press of people, shying away from an elderly woman who shoved past with vigour belied by her years. Presently they came to an open space that was less crowded, away from the centre, where stalls sold clothes and knick-knacks and sweetmeats. Her eye was caught by a Fletcher's stall, and she headed over to see about some arrows. Aaron made to go with her, but Cade stopped him. "Hoi," he said quietly. "Why's she acting weird?" Aaron couldn't resist a final glance at Fenn's back as she went. "She's not used to crowds," said Aaron. "She grew up in a cabin in the woods. Before she left the forest, the biggest town she ever saw was smaller than Shoal Point." How easily that knowledge tripped off his tongue. Why had she told Aaron that and not him? Didn't he entertain her with his stories? Didn't he make her laugh? Aaron's eyes had strayed to her again, checking on her. The Fletcher was trying to engage her in conversation as she perused his wares without much success. "Have you two done it?" Cade asked suddenly. The question welled up out of him, unstoppable as vomit. Aaron looked puzzled. "It?" "It!" said Cade, making an obscene gesture with his fingers to demonstrate. Aaron gaped. "No!" he cried. "No, of course we haven't. Why are you even asking that?" "Huh. Why? Reckon you know why," Cade said. He sounded sullen and didn't care. Aaron was bewildered. "Cade, she's not interested in me. Not like that." Cade pounced. "So you're interested in her?" Aaron opened his mouth to form a denial, but no words came out. Maybe he didn't know the answer himself then. Cade could see him formulating something diplomatic, the kind of meaningless response he was good at, so he decided to get in first. "I love her," he said hotly. "Laugh if you like, but it's true. I love her, and she's going to love me once she gets to know me well enough." He waited for Aaron to make a joke, to call it one of his fleeting crushes. He was ready to respond with anger. But Aaron just sagged, as if a great weight had settled on him. "Well," he said sadly, "then there it is." It wasn't the reaction Cade had expected. Too late he realized what he'd done. He'd laid claim to her, and by doing so, he'd forbidden Aaron from ever acting on his feelings. It was an ultimatum. Choose her and lose me. He hadn't meant it like that, but that was what it meant. He wanted to take it back, but he didn't know how. At last, he understood the feeling that had been growing inside him ever since that day when the Iron Hand came to Shoal Point, and two boys were taken away from home forever. "Everything's changing, ain't it?" he said. "No,"
said Aaron, wearing the smile of a brave liar.
No, it's not.
It is, Cade said, and he wanted to cry. But the worst thing is, I can't seem to stop it.
Cade saw in his eyes that he'd been thinking the same thing. The uncomplicated loyalty of youth couldn't survive outside the sheltered lands of home and childhood. Something else was taking its place, something fraught with doubt and conflict. He wasn't sure they'd ever again be the friends they once were, and it frightened him. Once, Cade had been happy to be led by Aaron in all things, but no longer. He wanted to be his own man, he wanted to be a Greycloak, and he wasn't sure Aaron really did. Aaron's heart was set on finding the answers to his father's death, not revolution. He was obsessed with Garrick, and Cade was starting to find his anger tiresome. Garrick was a hero who'd saved their lives over and over. It was the Crodans that killed Randall, not him. The worst Garrick had done was hit Aaron a few times, and it was hard for Cade to see what the fuss was about there, since he was no stranger to a clouting from his da. He knew Aaron's feelings on the issue were complex and all, but couldn't he just let it go? Then there was Fenn, the only girl in their new world. She divided them just by existing.
I wish we could go back to how it was, Cade said.
Nothing's changed, Cade, Aaron assured him, but there was something desperate in his voice.
It's still you and me, always.
Cade nodded glumly.
Aye. You and me, he said, his heart slowly sinking.
You and me and Grub, said Grub, slinging an unwelcome arm round their shoulders. He gave them a hideous grin. What we talking about?
Cade shoved him off, annoyed. The smell of him up close was like an ambush.
Dumb face not want to be friends? Grub asked,
pooching out his lower lip in a parody of sadness.
Grub's heart is broken.
Find anything interesting? Aaron asked, before Cade could come up with a snappy retort.
He'd always had more patience with the skull than Cade did.
Grub find many things. Ossians leave all sorts of valuables lying around. Lying around in their pockets, he added with a smirk.
Aaron sighed. You'll bring the watch down on us.
Grub shrugged.
You didn't want Grub to steal, shouldn't have brought him to a market.
Cade rolled his eyes.
No one brought you anywhere.
Ho! Oh, you there!
A neat young Crodan man in an expensive waistcoat pushed through the crowd.
Yes, you! The skull!
Grub adopted an expression of comical innocence, ruined by Aaron's obvious look of alarm. Cade gave Grub a furious glare.
Trust that fool to attract trouble now when they needed it least.
But the highborn man didn't seem angry.
Please, if you would wait a moment. My wife is just coming. We saw you in the crowd, and she's very eager to meet you. It's rare that she comes across someone from her homeland. Ah, here she is.
Grub's expression went from innocence to fear.
Grub has to go, he said,
but it was too late. A Skarl woman appeared next to her husband, flustered from the chase. She was tall, square-featured and striking, her hair in a complex arrangement of plaits. An elegant band of tiny tattoos followed her jawline and hairline and curled around the socket of her left eye. She wore an excited smile, which froze as she laid eyes on Grub and then drained slowly from her face.
"Aye, he's no looker, is he?"
Cade joked. But nobody laughed, and he knew he'd misjudged the situation. The woman's eagerness turned to hate and disgust, and Grub shrank before her.
"Is something wrong, my love?" the Crodan asked.
"Hanakut,"
she snarled in the angular language of her homeland.
"Skin thief!"
And she hawked and spat in Grub's face.
"Alenda!"
her husband cried in surprise, but she'd swept off into the crowd. He offered them a look of embarrassed apology and chased after her. Fenn returned from the Fletcher's stall to find Grub trembling, his face burning red, and a wad of greasy phlegm inching down his cheek. He turned and blundered away, pushing shoppers aside.
"Oi, Grub!" Cade called after him. "There's still something on your face!"
Aaron gave him an angry look, which surprised and hurt Cade.
"I'll go after him. You stay with Fenn.
Eh? What are you going after him for? He spends his whole life mocking everyone else. Let him be upset. Do him good to know how it feels.
I'm going after him because he's one of us, said Aaron sharply. And that's what we do. With that, he left. Cade felt something leave with him, some butterfly-like emotion, too vague to be named, fluttering out of his grasp. But he'd never been good with that sort of thing, so he shook off his unease and gave Fenn his best fake smile instead.
Well then, he said, looks like it's you and me.
68.
Skin thief.
Grubb's blood beat in his ears, throat hot, teeth gritted. He'd wiped away the woman's spit with his sleeve, but he still felt it there as he hurried through the streets, dizzy with rage and shame, barely aware of the people he was pushing past.
Skin thief!
Memories swarmed up of another woman who spat at him. The one who found him in the long hall feasting with heroes, who accused him and brought him down. His former friends dragged him to the priest's black stone halls and threw him before the somber men to answer his accuser.
Skin thief!
The somber men had listened, shaggy-haired and rancid, mouldering furs piled about their shoulders beneath sagging wide-brimmed hats. Their eyes were hidden behind bands of rag, and on each rag was daubed a new eye, the eye of Urgotha, the bone god who saw all lies. Beneath their blind gazes he told his story, protesting his innocence till the end. When he was finished, the foremost of the somber men leaned forward, skinned back lips over rotten teeth, and spoke the word that would damn him. Chanakut. They held him down as the skin scribe came for him.
Erase him, they said. Wipe the lies from his body.
But the skin scribe didn't. He leaned over Grubb, a tattooed skull face in the torchlight, and dragged the heel of his hand across Grubb's eyes. Grubb screamed as a pain like fire blazed in its wake. When it faded, an ugly black crescent remained, arcing from cheek to cheek. The mark of his shame, the sign of exile.
Chanakut.
He fled the shackle market with no direction in mind, his only desire to escape. He took turnings at random, his thoughts circling inwards, and only came to his senses when he reached a dead end. Before him was a low wall. He laid his hand on it and looked over. Some way below, cut into the slope of the hill, was the entrance to Patron's Bridge, busy with traffic heading from the north shore of the river to Sovereign's Isle. On a whim, he sat atop the wall with his feet dangling over the edge. It was a long way to the ground, far enough to kill. A crow flapped down from the heights, alighting a little further along. It strutted back and forth, watching him with a beady eye. Grubb watched it uneasily in return.
Bone gods watching, he thought. Bone gods waiting.
How long had he been exiled? He couldn't remember. A long time, anyway. A long time to be without friendship or a kind word. He'd shared rough camaraderie with the lowlifes of many Ossian ports over the years, but they didn't really count as friends. They were alliances of the moment, made out of shared need for shelter or to carry out a scam. A Skarl couldn't ever really be friends with a foreigner. They were not Skarls. Their feelings were worth no more than a horse's or a cat's. But his own people had cast him out. There were only foreigners left to him now. He heard footsteps coming up the street behind him. It was Mudslug. The boy clambered up on the wall alongside, dangled his legs next to Grubb's, and peered down at the crowd milling onto the bridge.
"Who are you aiming for?" Mudslug asked.
"Huh?"
"Well, if you're going to jump, you have to land on someone. Might as well make it count. Me, I'd go for that soldier there. He's got a look about him I don't like. And he's Croden."
He glanced over at Grubb. "What about you?" Grubb thought about that and pointed.
"Woman in red dress."
"The pregnant woman?"
"Yes.
Grub get two for the price of one. He grinned. Might as well make it count.
Mudslug shook his head in amazed disgust, but Grub reckoned he was reluctantly amused all the same.
Remember the first time we met? In the camp? Mudslug asked.
Eh? Grub beat up Mudslug.
You ever think we'd find ourselves here, sitting on a wall in Morganholm, deciding who best to squash with our falling bodies?
Grub gave him a look.
Course not, stupid. If Grub could see future, he wouldn't have been in camp in first place.
How did you end up in there anyway? You never told me.
Got caught pickpocketing. When Grub explained to Crodens how mighty he is, how many foes he vanquish, they not hang him, send him to mines instead.
You got caught pickpocketing? Mudslug was thinking about the market.
Grub produced an onyx figurine from his pouch, which he'd swiped from an inattentive vendor.
What did Mudslug say? History just a series of lessons we didn't learn.
Aaron gave a wry smile and brushed tangled brown curls back from his forehead.
You want to tell me what a skin thief is? He asked.
Grub sniffed and wiped his nose with his sleeve.
Did he want to tell him?
Funny way to say it, but then Ossian's talked in a funny way, and he'd never really got his head round the language. He wouldn't usually dream of sharing his shame, but Mudslug wasn't the kind to use it against him, and he felt low and lonely enough that it didn't really matter anymore. So maybe he did want to tell Mudslug. It seemed the sort of thing that friends did. He put the figurine back in his pouch.
Mudslug heard of the scattering?
I've heard of it, don't know much about it, though.
Skarl rite of passage. Firstborn of every family sent out into the world to do great deeds, bring back glory and riches. The rest stay at home, look after things. They say firstborns, lucky ones. They get to be heroes. Ha!
He began rummaging through his pockets and produced a silver hip flask with a delicate floral design, which he handed to Aaron to hold. Then he dug out a tinderbox and two fine cheroots, which he put between his lips.
Not easy to be a hero, not in Ossia.
He packed the tinderbox, struck sparks into it, and lit the cheroots from the glowing wad. Then he handed one to Mudslug, who took it without much enthusiasm, eyeing the soggy end where it had been in Grub's mouth.
Grub owes you some cheroots from back in the camp.
So you do, said Mudslug. I'd forgotten.
He took a drag and coughed hard. Grub cackled.
You get used to it, he said,
and clapped him on the back, almost pushing him off the wall to his death.
Have a drink. Make things better.
Mudslug unscrewed the lid of the hip flask, took a swig and began to cough harder.
What's in that?
He wheezed, handing it back.
Whatever was in it when Grub stole it.
Mudslug took a moment to regain control of his lungs. So you left home and came to Ossia, he said. What did you do then?
Nobody trusts Skarls here. Not much work. Grub look for ways to do great deeds, but soon he get hungry.
He shrugged.
What did Grub do? He wander. Do this, do that. Meet people, leave people. Smoke a lot of clawfoot root. Steal, fight, keep food in belly and breath in body, but great deeds? No. Years pass, nothing. Nothing worth putting on skin.
He took a draw on his cheroot and swigged the liquor in the hip flask. It was foul and herbal and tasted like the forest floor, but Grub wasn't particular, so he drank some more of it.
Then one day big change. Revolution in Dern. Priests and king and nobles all in trouble. Pay plenty for mercenaries. Grub go. Maybe he do something great there. Maybe he die with a rusty sword in his arse.
He glanced over at the crow further down the wall. He wished it would flap off. It was hard to tell the tale with the bone god listening.
On way, Grub find sight of recent battle. 200 dead, maybe more. Many crows, bone god looking for stories among the bodies. We look, too, for coin and riches. Dead men don't need fine things.
He took another swig of liquor to keep him going, then handed it back.
Grub find body. Skarl man. half his body all tattoos. Grub read them, become amazed. That man, he a hero.
He sighed then, lowered his head, felt the shame seep through him on a wave of alcohol warmth.
Then Grub realize, that man's name, nearly the same as Grub's. Just have to add one character and it exactly the same. Feel like all men to Grub.
What is your real name?
Don't have one. Name lost now. See?
He pointed to the spot where his left cheek met his eye socket, now entirely black.
Here where skulls have name, tribe, place of birth marked. Mine gone. Grub is Grub now, from nowhere.
You're always from somewhere. It doesn't matter what's written on your skin.
Matters to Bone God. Memories die, flesh rots. Only what's written lives on.
He waved it away. He didn't want to talk about that. There was no greater hell than to be unremembered. But why, Grub?
That's what they call me when I was part of Nuke's gang back in Caraca. Grub liked the sound of it in Ossian. Sound very elegant.
Mudslug had a dubious look on his face, but he held his tongue. Grub could tell he had questions about Nuke and Caraca and all of that, but he found he wanted to finish his story now he'd started it.
Grub decide to take Warrior's story for his own. Everyone think he do those things. Grub will be hero, feast in long halls with other heroes, treated with respect till the end of his days. Grub can go home. So Grub take the story, and he head for the coast.
You copied it from his skin?
Mudslug stupid. Only skin scribe can copy skin scribe tattoos.
So you carried him?
Grub snorted. No. He already starting to stink. Skinned him. Smoked it. Left the rest for the crows.
Mudslug's appalled stare was genuine this time. Grub didn't care. Mudslug didn't even know the worst of it yet.
Grub go to a needler. Used to be skin scribes, but they break laws, get exiled. They still know the secret arts, though. Best tattooists in the world sell their skills for money, get rich. Grub not rich, but he beg, and this man help a fellow skarl. All that warrior's great deeds written on my skin. Then I go to skarl sailor and say, take me home. And he honored to. Honored.
Grub dragged bitterly on the last of his cheroot and flicked it into the air, where it tumbled down into the crowd. Mudslug ground his out on the wall with some relief.
Worst thing one skarl can do to another is make him unremembered, said Grub.
Hard even to say this, but he had to.
Law says, you find a dead skarl, you bring them home so their deeds can be recorded. If you can't, leave them for the crows. Crows peck out eyes, see what they saw. Peck out tongues, learn what they spoke. Read the writing on their skin. All this they take back to the Bone God and he record it. Don't bury, don't burn. Leave nothing for the crows to read.
He let out a breath.
But when Grub was done with the skin, he burned it. Thought no one could prove what Grub did if they never found that skin. But they proved it anyway.
Mudslug looked at him like he understood, but he didn't understand. Only a skull could. How long before they caught you? He asked.
Few months. Life good. Women, feasting. Young men listen to my tales, buy me drinks. Then one day, old friend turn up. Old friend of his. They fight together on mainland. She track him down, and she know my face is wrong. Kanakut, she call me. Then they take me to the Black Triad.
His voice faded. He didn't really want to talk any more, but he had to say one last thing, if only to dull the barb a little.
They copied his story from me before they sent me away. At least Grub did that. Stone singers put it on wall of mausoleum somewhere. He not unremembered in the end.
Mudslug contemplated the crowd for a time. So you didn't kill an ice bear?
No.
Or ambush a shipload of Boscan smugglers?
No.
Or fight the Erds in the Sixth Purge? Or slay 10 Elleru all on your own?
Grubb did none of those things.
But you did escape the camp at Sulla's Bluff. We couldn't have done that without you.
Yes.
And you did save us at Skavengard. If you hadn't found a way round that collapsed room, we'd all have been killed by the beast, instead of just... He saddened visibly at the memory of Moustache. Well, you know...
Grubb did that. Still, it not enough.
What will be enough? Grubb puffed out his cheeks. The crow had flown away at some point. He hadn't noticed it leave.
Skarls have tail. Hero called Hagga. He slay his own brother, steal his skin. Caught and exiled. Rest of his life, he do things so heroic, such feats it hard to believe. Return with treasure. Somber men listen to his tale, call it true. Say he repaid his debt to the bone god. So skin scribes take away the mark of Kanakut.
He passed a hand across his eyes, as if he could wipe away the stain there.
Grubb must do something so great Bone God will forgive him. No faking this time. Then maybe he go home.
There was silence between them for the span of a dozen heartbeats. Then Grubb straightened and pointed.
Bitterbracker, he said.
Mudslug followed his gaze. The Bitterbracker was just stepping onto the bridge below them, heading across the river to Sovereign's Isle. He was easy to spot with his distinctive hair, grown long in a strip down the centre of his skull and shaved elsewhere. He moved in a furtive hurry, glancing over his shoulder.
Bitterbracker told us he's staying inside today, Grubb said. Grubb think he up to something.
Mudslug's frown deepened. So do I, he said, climbing down off the wall. Coming?
Grubb better come. Remember last time Mudslug tried to follow Grubb? Grubb taken dumps that were subtler.
Let's go then. Mudslug headed off to find a path down to the bridge, and Grubb went after him. He felt better after their talk. Mudslug was good blood, as they said back in Karaka. A trustworthy sort. Someone you could rely on. Grubb had even developed a sneaking fondness for him. Shame, then, what he planned to do once Garrick had retrieved the Ember Blade. For if that sword was all they said it was worth a king's ransom to Ossians and Crodans alike. What would the Somber men say if he were to bring it home as a present for his Thal? Wouldn't that be a deed out of legend? Grubb would let Garrick steal it, if he could. Then he'd steal it from Garrick. He felt a little regretful about it, but not much. A skull could never really be friends with a foreigner, after all. 69. Aaron and Grubb had to run to have any chance of catching up with Keel, so run they did. Luck favoured them, and they came across a stone stairway in the next street that led sharply down to the level of the bridge. There they fought their way through the festive crowds heading for Sovereign's Isle, searching for Keel as they went. Out on the bridge, the traffic cleared somewhat and they sprinted across. The River Kay sparkled beneath them, the painted sails of merchant ships moving in stately progress towards the sea. A pair of Crodan soldiers eyed them suspiciously as they raced past, and Aaron felt a sudden thrill of alarm. If we're stopped. He halted at the end of the bridge. Grubb lumbered up behind him, barely out of breath. He was slow, but apparently he could run forever.
Mudslug tired? Grubb grinned.
Aaron tried not to look at the guards, who were watching them.
We can't draw too much attention, he panted. We don't have permits for Morgenholm. If they ask to see our papers, we'll be arrested.
Didn't Mudslug think of that this morning?
He hadn't. He hadn't travelled much beyond Shoal Point. Excited by the prospect of exploring, and eager to defy Garrick's command, he'd taken a foolish and reckless risk. With the wedding coming up, the guards would be on high alert. All it took was one check, and this would all be over.
"Didn't you know we needed permits?"
Aaron retorted, angry at himself for his idiocy.
"Grab knew. He just didn't care."
He slapped Aaron on the arm.
"Come on, mudslug. Walk. Try not to look like a criminal."
"Me?"
They proceeded on to Sovereign's Isle, and to Aaron's great relief, the guards lost interest in them. Thereafter, they went at a quicker pace, but no faster than 100 other shoppers and harried clerks. Aaron scanned the grand square at the end of Patron's Bridge as they crossed it, searching for Keel among the faces that surrounded him.
"Bitter Bracker could be anywhere," Grubb said.
He was right, and perhaps it was pointless trying to catch Keel, but something in the way he'd been walking troubled Aaron. He was about some secret business. Aaron would be eaten by suspicion until he knew what it was. An idea occurred to him. "There's another bridge on the far side of Sovereign's Isle. We crossed it when we came from the docks."
"So?"
"So that's where we're going," he said, setting off in that direction. "If his destination is on Sovereign's Isle, we've lost him. But if he's heading for the south bank, we can catch him on the other bridge." Aaron's instincts proved right. They arrived at the promised bridge just in time to see Keel stepping off it. Grubb cackled.
"Mudslug make good spy yet. Now follow Grubb. Don't get too close."
Aaron followed Grubb's lead as they trailed Keel off the bridge and down the hill towards the canal district. The streets took on a seedy look as the alleyways narrowed and steepened, and there was a faint scent of rot in the air, rising from the lichen-slimed inlets further down the hill, where the land met the water. Houses leaned out over the street, and the people began to look crumpled and unhealthy. Grubb kept a far greater distance from Keel than Aaron would have done. Every time Keel turned a corner, Aaron was anxious they'd lose him, but Grubb had an instinct for where he was going next, and found him again immediately. There was clearly a skill to it, but it was a mystery to Aaron. Keel had stopped looking over his shoulder and was walking with purpose. Aaron guessed he was nearing his destination. Grubb closed in a little, perhaps fearing he'd disappear into some anonymous doorway. When Keel finally came to the end of his journey, they had him in sight, and Grubb pulled Aaron behind a corner to watch. The Burned Bear was a faintly unpleasant-looking inn that stood at the end of a terrace, with a dank thoroughfare running alongside it. Its timbers were painted with flaking pitch, and latticed windows of cheap glass turned its patrons into smeared ghouls. The sign showed a bear with ugly red burn wounds, chained to a pole, fighting dogs. Presumably there was a story to that name, but Aaron had another story to follow right now. They watched Keel go inside.
"Perhaps he just wants to get drunk?" Aaron suggested, though he didn't for a moment believe it.
"After Skaven Guard?"
"No need to sneak, then."
"He might be ashamed."
Grubb shook his head.
"Bitter Bracker meeting somebody."
Aaron hovered uncertainly, weighing his next move. He was sick of secrecy. Part of him wanted to storm in there, seize Keel and demand some straight answers. Even if it got him another beating, it would be worth it. But he'd learned the futility of asking for truth. It was not